He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. This is a prophecy that was written about 700 years before Jesus. But if you were to ask anybody in this world, for the most part, who this is talking about, they would tell you that it's talking about Jesus. Because with such accuracy, Isaiah prophesied 700 years before Jesus what would happen to him. And he talks about how in this prophecy that there would be no form or majesty about Jesus, that anybody would desire him. There would be nothing special about his pedigree from an earthly perspective. And this prophecy goes on to talk about how he would carry our sorrows, and because of his wounds, we would be healed. And it talks about him being rejected by men. Now, I have a question about that. When you think of the rejection of Jesus, what is the thing that comes to your mind? For me, I think of the cross and the crucifixion. And that's certainly the height and the pinnacle of the suffering that he experienced. But it's true at the same time that throughout his whole life he suffered rejection. And throughout his whole life people despised him. And what we're going to see in this lesson is a text in Mark chapter 6, where Jesus goes to his hometown, and his hometown people reject him. And the reason that they reject him is something that we have to be very careful that we don't do, because it's something that we can slip into as well. So we're going to see the reason why they reject him as we progress through the lesson, but I want us to start out by reading the text in Mark chapter 6, verses 1 through 6. The text reads, "And he went away from there and came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, 'Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?' And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, 'A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own household.' And he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. And he went about the villages teaching." Now, as we've been going through the book of Mark, it's helpful to remember the big picture of how the book is divided. You can split the book of Mark into two main sections. The first section is chapters 1 through 8, and it's proving that Jesus is the king. Through various prophecies, Mark is showing you that Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah. Through many miracles, he's showing you that he has the power of a king. Through casting out demons, Mark is showing us that Jesus is conquering the enemy of sin, Satan, and death. So the first 8 chapters of Mark prove and show Jesus is the king. But there's something unique about this king, which we're going to get to in future lessons. But chapters 9 through 16, you can remember with the word cross. The king has to be exalted on a cross. And he's going to suffer, and he's going to die, and he's going to be rejected. That's, like I said before, the pinnacle of his rejection that he received. So we're still in the section in Mark where we're seeing that Jesus is the king. Mark is proving to us that Jesus is the long-awaited king. And from this text, we're going to learn that he is rejected even by people in his own hometown. And this sets up an interesting contrast, because you remember in Mark chapter 5, there's a big emphasis on belief. There's 3 times in Mark chapter 5 that people bow down before Jesus. Remember, we have the Gerasene demoniac who had all of the demons inside of him. We have Jairus, the synagogue ruler. He falls down before Jesus. And then we have the unnamed woman who had been bleeding for 12 years, and she also falls down before Jesus. Mark chapter 5 pictures true belief in Jesus, and how Jesus can do mighty works in people who actually believe. But when we get to Mark chapter 6, we have a sharp contrast. we suddenly get to a lot of people who lack belief in Jesus. And that's why in verse 5, the text is going to talk about how Jesus could do no mighty work in his own hometown because the people didn't believe in him. And further on in Mark chapter 6, we're going to see the beheading of John the Baptist. So Mark shows us the great faith in chapter 5, and then chapter 6, he's going to show people who do not have faith in him. Now, one of the interesting things about this text, and one of the unique things about this text, is it gives us a lot of insights about Jesus' background, which is why it connects with Isaiah 53, that he would have no former majesty that people would desire him. Now, what are the things that we learn about Jesus' background in this scene? If you look at verse 1, sorry, that was weird. If you look at verse 1, you'll notice that Jesus was from the city of Nazareth. Now, the Old Testament never mentions the city of Nazareth. You won't find it there. The historian Josephus never mentions the town of Nazareth. You won't find it there either. But archaeological discoveries have shown that this town had no more than 500 people in it. It was one of those podunk kind of towns where everybody would have known each other. And this isn't a town of royalty. Now, we know from the beginning of Matthew chapter 2, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And we know from the end of Matthew chapter 2 that he was raised in Nazareth. That's where he was from. So that's one interesting thing about his background. He's not from a very desirable town. What else do we learn about his background? Actually, let me say this one other thing about this town of Nazareth. Nathanael in the book of John, he was the one who famously was quoted as saying, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" That was the reputation that this town had. Nothing good can come from that slum of a town. That's how people thought of it. Now, if you skip down to verse 3 in our text, we learn something interesting about Jesus, that he was a carpenter. If I'm not mistaken, if I remember correctly, this is the only verse in the Bible that actually says Jesus was a carpenter. The other ones that associate him with carpentry work say that his dad was a carpenter. But this verse says that he's a carpenter. Now, Jesus grew up in this town that wouldn't have a lot of trees. He would have worked with some wood. He would have made yoke for oxen and things like that. He probably made chairs and tables. But what he probably worked with more than anything else would have been stones. And so he would have perhaps built structures for King Herod, because just a few miles north of where Jesus lived, there was a big construction project during Jesus' time period that perhaps he worked on. He would have worked a lot with stones, though. And so he would have basically been viewed as a construction worker. That's how people would have viewed him, because that's the kind of work he did. Look at this also in verse 3. Jesus in the same text is called the Son of Mary. And that's significant to point that out. The Son of Mary. In this time period, if you were a Jew, people would associate you with your father. The text doesn't say the son of Joseph, it says the Son of Mary. Now, why would these people associate Jesus with Mary? There's a couple reasons for that. Maybe one option is that at this point, Joseph has passed away. The last time we read about Joseph in the New Testament is in Luke chapter 2, when Jesus is 12 years old in the temple. And after that scene, we don't read about Joseph anymore. And it's possible that at this point, Joseph has passed away, so people remember Jesus as the son of Mary. That's one option. But here's another option. Think about the scandal of a virgin birth and how people would have looked at Jesus and his family. If somebody walked into this room and said, "I'm pregnant, but I'm a virgin," none of us would believe her. Can you imagine the kind of scandal it would have been for Mary? How for years and years, people would have seen her in a certain way. And so it's possible that when they say, "This is the son of Mary," that they're associating that with their preconceived notions about what they think actually happened to them. And so it's more of a scandalous thing than anything. But Jesus is the son of Mary, not from a noble family. Now, something else that we learn about Jesus' background here is in verse 3 also. Verse 3 is really helpful for his background, is that Jesus had biological siblings. And the reason that I point that out is because there's some train of thought that some people have that Jesus never had biological half-brothers or half-sisters. But this text shows us that Jesus did in fact have brothers and sisters, and the people in Jesus' own hometown say, "Is he not the brother of so-and-so," and so on and so forth. And so these people all recognize that. But when we think about all of this stuff from Jesus' background, he's not from a great city. He's a construction worker. He's perhaps associated, or the way that people think about him is perhaps associated with sexual immorality. And when you put all of that together, Jesus has very ignoble beginnings. There is nothing about his form that people would desire this man. But it's interesting in this text that Jesus is finally returning to his hometown. Can you imagine, on this Sabbath day when Jesus comes to the synagogue, he comes back to his hometown. He comes back to his stomping grounds. And he's with his disciples, according to verse 1. Imagine all the people in the town. Oh, Jesus, we grew up with you. It's awesome to see you again. But you got this ragtag bunch of 12 men that are with him. You got a former terrorist in Simon the Zealot. You got Matthew the tax collector. You got a bunch of fishermen. If you are in this town and you see Jesus, the homeboy, coming back, I don't mean homeboy in the way that, or homebody is what I meant to say. You have Jesus, this guy that grew up in this town, he's coming back with all of these strange people. What are you going to think about this? So try to imagine this scene. It's the Sabbath day, and they're at the synagogue on the Sabbath. And as an interesting side point, one of the things that you see in the Gospels is that whenever it's the Sabbath day, Jesus is at the synagogue. Whenever Jesus has an opportunity to worship, that's what he's doing. And I think we can learn some lessons from that. But Jesus is in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He's entering probably the same building that he went to growing up. Again, this is his stomping ground. And while he's there, he's asked to teach. And he starts teaching. Now, in this time period, and we actually do the same thing today, when there's a preacher that's traveling, we'll oftentimes ask them, hey, do you want to preach for us today? So Jesus is in his hometown. He's asked to teach on that day. And can you imagine the excitement of all the people in the audience? I don't know if they had a pulpit. I don't know what they were using. But Jesus gets up front, and there's all of these people that would have had memories of him when he was growing up. There's all of these people that probably remember when he was a baby. There's all of these people who probably remember when he was a teenager. And he went through all of those different stages in life. And you can imagine them, oh, good thing to see Jesus back here. We're really excited to have him speak for us today. So that's what he's going to do. And he gets up and he starts preaching to the people. Now, we don't know all the things that Jesus said when he was preaching to them. But in verse 2, we have one emotional reaction that the people have. The text says that they were astonished or amazed at his teaching. They were amazed that this guy who grew up in their town is teaching the way that he's teaching. Now, if you take most people in the world and you find out that they're astonished or they're amazed at Jesus' teaching, you would think that that's a good thing. But you can be amazed at the teachings of Jesus, but not impressed by them. And you can be amazed at Jesus' teaching, but not changed by them. Which leads into the second emotional reaction that they have in the text. In verse 3, the text says that they took offense. And they're asking these questions, what is this wisdom given to him? How are these mighty works done by this man? And isn't this the carpenter? Don't we know his family? Don't we know all about this guy? And so when in the Greek, when it says they took offense, it's the Greek word scandalizo, which sounds kind of similar to the word scandalized. These people thought it was like a scandal that Jesus was teaching in these ways. Here's the homebody that they thought they had figured out, that they thought they had pegged down, and here he is preaching some things that I guess are convicting the people. And they just get offended by him. That's the response that they have. Now, imagine Jesus as he's standing before these people. And if I just want to know what their faces look like as Jesus looked out at them. I imagine some people whispering. By the way, preachers can totally see what people are doing when they're preaching. Like, sometimes people think there's like a magical wall where I can't see what's happening. I can totally see what's happening. So, like, I imagine Jesus as he's standing up there. And he can see some people kind of like whispering to each other and like frowning and getting frustrated that this hometown guy that's finally returned home is talking about repenting and the kingdom and all of these things that may be in their life that they need to change. And Jesus' response to this is that that a prophet goes without honor except in his hometown and amongst his own family members. In other words, a prophet can go anywhere he wants to go and be honored, but if he goes to his own family, his own hometown, people are not going to honor him. And Jesus' response to this is interesting. Jesus is marveled at their unbelief. He's marveling at their unbelief. Did you know that Jesus marvels at unbelief in the face of evidence and in the face of such obvious conclusions that we would have to reach about him? Now, we see in this text that Jesus did not do many mighty works. And we might look at that and say, well, I guess Jesus' power was just limited. Suddenly when he was in his hometown, there's like this force field in the town and he just couldn't do miracles. The parallel account in Matthew chapter 13, verse 58 says that Jesus did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. And that's important to point that out. Jesus doesn't do mighty works in the lives of people who don't believe. If I don't believe in Jesus and I lack faith in him, I will not see life transformation. It's not going to happen. And so when Jesus is in this town and all these people get scandalized because of what he's doing, that's what happens. And I find the rest of verse 6 amazing. The rest of verse 6 says, "And he went about among the villages teaching." You know why that's impressive to me? Because even after Jesus is rejected in his own hometown, he doesn't slouch down and go, "Well, I better just stop preaching and teaching because nobody wants to listen anymore." He gets rejected in his hometown, and then he still goes out among the villages teaching and preaching. He won't stop. Now that's the scene that we have. That's the painting that Mark gives us. Now I want us to make some observations as far as lessons go from this. I think there's two main things that I want us to see in this. The first one is what the disciples would have learned from this. And the second one is talking about the nature of unbelief. Notice in verse 1 again, that when Jesus comes to his hometown, he's with the disciples. And I want you to imagine that you're one of the disciples in this scene. To be a disciple means that you're a pupil. It means that you're a student of somebody. I used to get guitar lessons. I've talked about this before. I used to get guitar lessons. And the goal of that pupilship, if that's a word, was to become like my guitar teacher. The goal of being a pupil of Jesus is that I want to become like him. I want to experience what he experienced. I want to think like he thinks. I want to be everything that he is. And so here we have these disciples, and it's interesting that the text specifically uses the word disciple. And they're going out with Jesus here. Do you know what Jesus does with these disciples right after this scene? Right after this scene, in verses 7 and 8, Jesus is going to send the disciples out to go preach and teach. I think there's a reason that this happened right before they're sent out to preach and teach. Because I think Jesus is allowing the disciples to experience the rejection of Jesus so that they know what might happen to them as they go out to preach and teach. And so if you're one of the disciples, what would be some of the lessons that you would learn as you're sent out? Here's some things that I think if I was a disciple, I hope I would have learned from this. The first thing is this, that teaching your hometown can sometimes be hard. Now, a couple weeks ago, we looked at the Gerasene demoniac, where Jesus told him, "Go to your hometown and tell everybody what the Lord has done for you." And the next time Jesus comes to Decapolis, there's a big crowd of people waiting for him. So evidently that Gerasene demoniac was able to teach a lot of people in his hometown. But this story helps us balance it out a little bit. It's so hard sometimes to teach those that we're closest to. Sometimes it can be hard for people who become Christians to be able to teach their parents and their family because they remember when you were a baby and they remember what you used to be like and they don't really think that you can shake some of those sins that we know that were in your life. And so we just don't know if you're really serious about this relationship with Jesus that you've entered into. And so we're not really sure if we want to really listen to what you have to say about that. Furthermore, it kind of hurts our pride a little bit to listen to what you have to say to me. Have you ever had that happen? people who are really close to you, family members, where you're trying to talk to them about the Lord, and they're just rejecting, and they're rejecting, and they're rejecting. If I was a disciple, I think I would have learned from this that when I try to go back to my family, it might be pretty hard. Which is maybe why there's wisdom sometimes in getting your family to study with other people and not just you. But one of the encouraging things about this for me is what eventually happens to Jesus' family. Jesus' family in Acts chapter 1 have become disciples. Can you imagine how hard it would be for you to convince your siblings and your family that you're the Son of God? Go try that. Jesus did that. Because of the proof of the resurrection. And there's two letters in the New Testament written by Jesus' half-brothers. The letter of James and the letter of Jude, which in the Greek could also be Judas, but we don't want to call it that. It's Jude. And so two of his half-brothers write letters in the New Testament. And so even though teaching hometown can be hard, eventually they might come around. Here's something else that if I was a disciple, I think I would have learned. There comes a time where I have to shake the dust off my feet. If you're starting to cast pearl before swine and people are just not interested in listening anymore, there comes a time where you just have to stop. Tell them I'm more than willing to study with you at a later time, but you're clearly not interested right now, so I'm going to go to the other villages and the other areas where I can start teaching people. Have you ever seen this happen with a Christian? Where they have a list of like one or two people that they just have to have saved. And they only spend their efforts on those one or two people. And they keep rejecting, 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 rejecting. And all that time they could have used their energy teaching other people who maybe would have accepted. There comes a time to shake the dust off our feet. And closely connected with that, rejection didn't make Jesus stop. Even though his hometown rejected him, he continued to go on and talk to more and more people. There's a time when I was in college and I was talking to an older Christian and he was asking me about the Bible studies I was having with the students on campus. And he asked me this question and it just struck me as odd. He said, "Do you find that people are really even interested in the gospel today anymore?" Do you want to know why I think he asked that question? I don't think he asked that question because he had a bad heart. I think he asked that question because him and his wife had tried teaching so many people and so many people rejected. And so they just stopped. And they started thinking that people just weren't interested anymore. We can fall into the trap where if one or two people reject, we just conclude nobody's interested anymore. And Jesus didn't think that way. So if I was a disciple, those would be some of the things that I would hope that I would learn from that. Let's switch now to talking about the unbelief of the hometown. I want us to talk a little bit about the nature of the unbelief that these people had. Look at verse 2 again in our text. In Mark chapter 6, verse 2, it says, "And on the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, 'Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands?'" Do you see the nature of their unbelief? They aren't denying that Jesus is wise. They aren't denying that Jesus does mighty works. They're not denying any of that. But the thing that they are denying is how Jesus could even have this. They're not denying that Jesus is amazing, but they are denying that nobody from our town, and we know our hometown, there's nobody that can come from our hometown and be this amazing. So maybe they're concluding that he has his power by the devil, like people concluded in Mark chapter 3. The nature of their unbelief is not complete rejection in everything Jesus is doing, but they're shocked that he would have that ability. Now, I want us to think a little bit about why these people rejected him in that way. This is so important. They thought they understood Jesus. They thought they understood Jesus, and that's why they rejected him. These people could talk about the kind of work Jesus did. Maybe there was people in the synagogue that day that's like, "Dude, every day I go home, I sit in the chair he made me. He's a pretty good carpenter, but that's all he is. He's a reliable carpenter, but that's all he is." And then there's other people in the audience thinking, we know Jesus' family. He's just a chip off that old block, and those people are a little strange. And so there's no way that Jesus could actually be this amazing. They thought that they had Jesus pegged. And they grew up with him. Can we grow up with Jesus and think that we have him pegged? And because of that, we just end up rejecting him? Why did these people reject him? They thought they had him figured out, but they had bad expectations. They had expectations that the Messiah would come from a royal family. They had expectations that the Messiah would be professionally trained by a rabbi. They had expectations that the Messiah would come in riding on a giant stallion and kill all the Romans. They had preconceived notions on what they wanted the Messiah to be and do. Are there people today who reject the Messiah because they have expectations of what they want the Messiah to be? People don't come to Jesus on their own terms. They come to Jesus on his terms. There's all kinds of people in our culture who think it's a scandal that Jesus taught that there's only one way to salvation. There's all kinds of people in our culture who think it's a scandal that the Bible teaches that homosexuality is a sin. There's all kinds of people that think that so much of what Jesus said, did, and taught is a scandalous thing. And so rather than transforming their lives to fit Jesus, they want to transform Jesus to fit their lives or just reject him altogether. And that's what these people do. Because Jesus, if I'm going to follow him, it's going to be on my terms and not his. Do you see the problem with these people? Do you see the problem in our culture? Before we just point the finger at our culture, though, we have to analyze our own lives. Have you ever heard the phrase before that familiarity breeds contempt? That the more that you become familiar with something, we can just start to think it's just not that exciting anymore. We need to be careful. Now, if you're going to genuinely become more and more familiar with God, it's only going to lead to more and more zeal and excitement for him. But I've talked to so many people who grew up getting to know Jesus. And people have told me things like this before. I just don't really serve God anymore because I've kind of been there, done that. I grew up getting to know him. I kind of figured out what he's all about, and I'm not really interested in that. The danger of thinking that you got Jesus figured out is one of the reasons these people rejected him. Do you know what we can do sometimes? If we've read the whole Bible one time, we've kind of gotten a surface understanding of it, and we're good with it. I'm going to suggest that the moment we think we have him figured out completely is the moment we start to backslide. And I don't know if you're here tonight and you've been feeling like you're not as excited about Jesus anymore. And you're not as zealous to dig into God's word and really understand who he is. And sometimes the reason for that is that we think we already know a lot about him. And because of that, we just end up rejecting. Here's the challenge in this lesson. No matter how much you might know about Jesus, you don't know as much as you ought to know. And that same thing goes for me. We never know as much as we ought to. And the moment we think that we've become too familiar is the moment we start to fall away. We always have to believe and trust that there's more things to find out and more things to discover and not be like the hometown who becomes so familiar with him, so they think, that they're just going to go ahead and reject the harder things that he has to say. Verse 5 is scary. Jesus could do no mighty work. Do you suppose that we could come and sit in these pews 3 times a week and become familiar with Jesus, become familiar with Jesus, become familiar with Jesus, but he never does a mighty work in our life? The anger never goes away. The sinful passions never start to go away. We keep treating other people in harsh and manipulative ways. We never grow compassion. He doesn't do any mighty work in our life Because even though we're coming every week, we're not allowing Him by true faith to really allow Him to change our life. That's the people in Jesus' hometown. We can't be Jesus' hometown. We can't. Otherwise, we become stale and no mighty work gets done in our hearts. This whole text is a microcosm of the world. The world, in a lot of ways, is like the hometown of Jesus. The world rejects Jesus because He never wrote a book. He wasn't from a royal family. He was a lowly man. Why should I make Him my Lord? But before we think that everybody rejected Him, in verse 6, or in verse 5 rather, there was a small minority of people who did still believe as Jesus went out to continue to heal and preach. In this world that's like this hometown, are we going to be the minority of people who allow Jesus to do mighty works in our life? And by the way, the reason that He can do these mighty works in our life is because He was despised and rejected. He was crucified on a cross and resurrected so that we don't have to fear death. And so that that same power that resurrected Him can now work in us so that those mighty works can be done. If there's anybody here tonight that needs to rekindle their passion for the Lord and come to the understanding that none of us know what we ought to know about Him, this is sure good an opportunity for you to get to understand more and more who He is and what He wants from your life. If there's anybody that needs to come back to the Lord, or if there's anybody that needs to be baptized into Christ tonight, this is an opportunity for you to do that while we stand and while we sing.